All right, good afternoon, everybody. We have no microphone. Microphone? Hello, Central. Is that working? Doesn't sound like it's working to me. Not obviously. There we go. Always helps. Turn off the mute button. Good afternoon, everybody. It's good to be back. Picking up the thread of cognitive modeling. Over the course of this week, you got a sort of general introduction, which connected up with the theory explanation stuff of 10 days ago on Tuesday, and on Friday, that's tomorrow, Helen's going to pick up with production systems and representationalist or symbolic approaches to cognitive modeling, but we're going to be, as does in some ways the Words and Rules book itself, we're going to be twin tracking from now on, contrasting two different kinds of approaches or two different architectures or two different groundings for looking at modeling. And by the end of today, we're going to be looking at one particular approach to modeling that came to prominence in the 1980s, known as neural networks. But to connect up with the sort of general theoretical framework that we've been talking about, the first thing to observe is, if you think way back to the first or second lecture, when I talked about layers of implementation, layers of explanation, the decomposition or the explanation of what happens when I press the key on this laptop connected to the web browser, you know, all the layers of description, the different layers at which you can describe what just happened to cause the text that you see on the screen to change. And I drew a parallel at that time with the idea of layered kinds of explanations for the mental, for cognitive processes in general. We're now going to have to sort of pick our level. That's what we're going to be talking about to some extent. Typically, although not exclusively, but typically people don't try to model human cognition by starting out with a finite elements simulation of individual sort of micron diameter regions in nerve cells. You could, in principle, do that. You could say, we want to simulate cognition? Right. We're going to build ourselves a brain. And to build a brain, we need neurons. And to build neurons, we need cell bodies and axons and dendrites. And to get them to work, we need the biochemistry and the electrochemistry to work. And so we're going to simulate it right down at the chemical level. Well, you could do that. And people have actually gotten simulations of handfuls of neurons running at the level of, you know, cross-sections of the axon being modeled as little electrochemical cells. And you can just about do that with today's supercomputers if you have a lot of patience. Whole brain, not in our lifetimes. But if you're doing something at a very much lower level, as Barbara Webb does, and she will come and give a guest lecture in a couple of weeks about her work with crickets, where some of what she's looking at with cricket behavior involves only a very small number of neurons, she really does build electric circuitry where elements in the circuit correspond pretty directly to neurons in the cricket's, it doesn't have a brain, but it has a ganglion. For lower organisms, you can get away with this, but even for people who think about cognitive science as brain science, there's a layering that goes on. You don't model directly at the neural level. You don't, in other words, in the same way that we don't explain what you see here just by talking about what's going on in the silicon, or even what's going on in the gates and the registers, but in terms of higher levels. We do the same when we build cognitive models. And we don't even, at least not these days, historically, if you go right back to the 50s and 60s when this thing started, there were a few examples of people basically taking general purpose programming languages like the predecessor of C or Lisp or Prolog and building cognitive models directly in a programming language. But by and large, they're layered on top of some kind of architectural model, some kind of higher level language in the programming sense or higher level architecture, which has properties of its own, which the people involved in this, in whatever effort we're talking about, think are appropriate for building cognitive models. And so, as I said, tomorrow you'll look at production systems, which were the vehicle of choice for the group at Carnegie Mellon, who made an awful lot of important progress in the 70s and 80s. They were mentioned on Tuesday, and you'll see much more about that tomorrow. Or alternatively, from a very different perspective, with a very different, if you will, sort of scientific ideology behind them, artificial neural networks, which is what we're going to talk about today, or perceptron networks. And at least with hindsight, you could say, and there, you know, historic, if you look at the history of this over the period of about 40 years, 30 years, starting in the 1940s, the neuron was the inspiration. People started asking in the 1940s, as the basics of brain neurophysiology began to be pretty clearly understood, what kind of computation is going on here? Because the 40s saw the invention, essentially the public emerging from the Bletchley Park and the and Los Alamos, the digital first digital computers emerging from the weapons laboratories into the public view, into the scientific consciousness. And so the question that emerged as a result of this for some people was, what kind of computation is a neuron doing? Right? Can we think of the neuron as implementing some kind of computational behavior? And if so, what would that be? And so eschewing modeling the neuron at the molecular, the chemical, or the electrical level, these people were saying, what can we do at the computational level? How can we talk about neurons and assemblages of neurons as if they were computing some kind of function? And in the 40s and 50s, a computational model of the neuron emerged, which it would be fascinating to take you through, but I don't have the time. So I'm going to jump over the history and come more or less to the conclusion straight away. But if you're interested, these are the people to search for. Read the Wikipedia article or find an introductory textbook. McCulloch and Pitts were the first. Hebb was the first to talk about learning and how neurons developed and changed. And Rosenblatt was the one who gave us the first abstraction that who was the first person to sort of write down the abstraction in something close to the form that we're going to use it now. And Minsky and Papert then went on to prove some things about what you could and couldn't do with that abstract unit called the perceptron that Rosenblatt had defined. We talked about this question of what you're going to model, what parts of the thing that you're looking at actually matter to you. What are you going to, in that horrible word which we are all struggling to pronounce, operationalize? And what you're going to leave out, what you don't care about. And you can get a pretty good idea of what Rosenblatt's perceptron is just by making that set of choices. So we start with a neuron. And we say, what do we care about? What are we going to operationalize in our model? What are we going to project into the model? And when we look at the perceptron, we draw it in a way which attempts to at least metaphorically, elicit some sense of the geometry, or at least the topology, of a neuron. And we label the bits that we care about, label the aspects that we're going to model. And each of these labels in the drawing corresponds to something in the neuron that we've chosen to include in our model. And in particular, the inputs and the weights are the way we model synapses. You will recall from the very first of the vision lectures when we talked about excitation and inhibition, that it's at the synapse that the signal coming into a nerve is converted either into an uptick or a downtick, right? Is either something that's going to contribute to the neuron itself firing or is going to make it less likely that the neuron fires. And the way this is represented in the perceptron is by saying that each input to a perceptron is associated with a weight between minus one and plus one that dials up or down the significance of an input coming in along that connection. So the inputs themselves are what model the dendrites, the things that come in. The output is the axon. The output is itself a level, a value, which is what, if you will, is what's model, is the model corresponding, is what corresponds in the model to the firing rate of the neuron. And so, of course, it's always going to be positive, as a neuron can't fire negatively. And by convention, again, we'll take it to range between 0 and 1. And finally, what it is the neuron does, and this is, if you will, the heart of, I mean, the rest of this is all sort of, Stop. Stop, you two. Go back down. Sorry about that. What it is the neuron does, right, is convert some constellation of inputs into an output firing rate. And we're going to model that in a very simple way using a function and a threshold, where the function is always going to be a function from the sum of the inputs times their weights. So if an input ranges between 0 and 1, then the thing that we're going to add up is the sum of those times the relevant weights. And that's going to give us a number. And then we're going to compare that to the threshold. And in the simplest case, we're going to output a 1 if it's above the threshold and a 0 otherwise. And as we see later on today, there are more complicated output functions, which actually are where the number output is really is a function of, rather than just a sort of a thresholding, a function of the threshold and the sum that we have here. And in order to just give you a feel for this and to illustrate what people started out doing in order to see what they could do with these things, we'll look at using perceptrons just to do elementary logic, because this was where the effort started itself. And we're going to simplify things so that not only are all the inputs going to be 0 or 1, but so are the outputs, because we'll take the sum and just check it against the threshold and output 1 if it's greater than the threshold and 0 otherwise. So inputs are 1 or 0, outputs are 1 or 0. The weights, we still say, yes, those can range between minus 1 and plus 1. And as we'll see in a minute, it actually, the function itself may incorporate a little built-in bias. So there's the perceptron, all you need for AND, for something which outputs a 1 if both its inputs are on. And it's sort of obvious how that's going to work, right? You could have sort of figured this out. And that's one of the reasons why this was sort of attractive and straightforward, because it made sense. You could look at it and say, yeah, I can see that, right? If only one input is on, then the sum is going to be 0.5, and it's not going to fire. And obviously, if neither input is on, the sum is going to be 0, and it's not going to fire. But if both inputs are on, the sum will be 1, which is greater than or equal to 1, so it will fire. So we can get what the AND gate does, what an AND in logic does. If you think for a minute, you can guess what the OR gate is going to look like. It's going to be almost the same. All we have to do is lower the threshold. And now, if either input is on, the sum will be 0.5, and the result will be that the output is 1. Of course, if they're both on, the output is still 1. The only way the thing is not going to fire is if both inputs are 0. Well, that's okay. Right? That makes sense. And we can do some of the more complicated ones. The NAND gate, which is the opposite, if you will, of OR, which says, I'm true only if neither of my inputs is on. So I'm only true if both of them are off. And we play a little clever game here with the weighting and with the bias. We've got a bias in here of 2. And we say, right, the only way that this is going to fire, right, if either of these is on, then the result's going to be too little, right? It's only if they're both off, right? I always get confused about this. Right. If they're both off, then we won't have any inhibition and the thing will fire. And somewhat surprisingly, indeed so surprising that the early literature about this was a little bit over the top and actually predicted that the perceptron could compute any logical function. They were so enthusiastic about their new toy that they missed a very simple example, which is that there's one simple logical function that the perceptron can't reproduce, and that's the XOR, which is A or B, but not both. So 0, 1 is good, 1, 0 is good, but 0 is bad, and 0, 0 is bad, and 1, 1 is bad. The reason for this is sort of deep, and it took a while to prove it, to prove that there's no way to do it, but intuitively, it's not hard to get your head around. One way to think about it is, if you plot the sum of the weighted inputs against the sum of the raw inputs, you have to get a straight line for any two-input configuration. Doesn't matter, right? Whatever the weights are, whatever the bias is, you're going to get a straight line, and it's going to be the origin is going to be at 0 or at the bias if there is one, and it's going to go off either upwards if the weights are positive and downwards if the weights are negative, But the problem is that if you think about this as I've described it, in the case of XOR, that means no matter where this line is, what direction it's pointing, there are going to be two false points in the middle. Sorry, the two true points are in the middle, separating the two false points. And there's no single way to divide that line which gives you the answer you want. Right? There's no way you can there's nowhere you can draw the threshold which will leave the right answers on the right side of the division. I think I don't want to take a question because it's, as I said, it's actually quite difficult to prove this. This is just meant to give you an idea. I'll talk to you about it afterwards. The other thing that's really interesting about perceptrons, and the other reason, the reason that people, you know, if this was just another way of doing logic, who cares, right? But what's interesting about it is you can train it. It can, in inverted commas, learn. And I want to take a little time over this because one of the things you will perhaps remember from any early discussion of computers and from the discussion of computers that went on right up until, and in fact in the public view, for many, many decades after perceptrons were invented, was the statement, computers can't do anything that we don't tell them how to do. Right? Computers are just our tools. They do what we tell them. Right? You have to put the program into the computer. What you put in the computer determines what the program will do. So computers can't do anything original. They can't learn. Right? They have to do what you tell them to do. Well, this very tiny little computational device, which a 15-line Python program, which I'm going to illustrate with in a minute, can implement, can learn how to compute the functions to do, for instance, the logic or some other things, which we'll talk about in a minute, if you give them examples of correct input-output pairs, which you can think about is not very different from a lot of ways in which the world teaches behavior. It rewards animals that eat things that are good for them, and it punishes animals that eat things that are bad for them. So it gives them lots of good input-output information, good input-output pairs. And indeed, the whole behaviorist psychological view was based on the idea that the world gave you all the training you needed to explain all of behavior, a position which has by and large been discredited. But at the lowest possible level of mechanism here, it works just fine. Right? So the basic viewpoint is, you've got a perceptron, it has some inputs, it has some weights, it has a threshold, it has a function that computes an output, and you give it pairs of a set of values for the inputs and the correct value for the output. And for the little logic functions, all you need is four sets for two inputs, right? Because the only possible inputs are 0 and 0, 0 and 1, 1 and 0, or 1 and 1. And the truth table, that's a phrase you've heard elsewhere, tells you for whatever thing you're trying to learn, whether it's AND or XOR, right, what the output should be. So there are four pairs of inputs and desired output. And you present those to the machine in a way which we'll talk about in a minute, and it will learn the right weights to give the result that you've trained it on. If you train it on the pattern for OR, it will learn the right weights for OR. If you train it on the pattern for AND, it will learn the right weights for AND. And the way you do that is, you can almost figure this out on the spot. In fact, some of you maybe have done so. So what do? You've got a perceptron, you feed it the inputs, it produces an output, you know what the truth is. If it gives the right output, you say, good perceptron, and you go on to the next. Right? But if it predicts one, we're taking the simple logic case for the time being, it's easier to explain. If it predicts one when the truth is zero, then you say, bad perceptron, and you reduce all the weights that were used, right? So every weight that contributed to getting the weight above the threshold, you say, nope, we'll make that weight a little smaller. And maybe you lower the bias a little bit as well, since that contributes as well. The result of that is that that particular set of inputs is a little less likely to get over the threshold the next time. On the other hand, if it predicted zero when it should have predicted one, now you really can see what's coming next, you increase the weights that were used a little bit to say, right, you know, this set of inputs should be a little more likely to get you over the threshold next time. And you do that for each input, output, set, in turn, over and over again, until the weights stop changing, or until you get everything right, at which point you know you've won. And we call that little bit. How much am I going to add to the weights? How much am I going to add to the bias? The learning rate. Because if you think about it, the bigger that number is, the faster it's going to try to get to where it's going. But if you make it too big, it'll overshoot and oscillate. So getting the right learning rate is a little tricky. In the examples I'm about to use, I've taken a fairly conservative rate, given the scale of the inputs and everything else, of 0.1. Right? So what this means is, if it says 1 when it should have said 0, I'm going to subtract 0.1 from all the weights that were involved, and vice versa. And that approach to learning, of which there are a number, right, but this is probably the simplest and certainly the easiest to understand, is called the delta rule, because the idea is that delta is a Greek letter often used to describe a change. You make a little change across the board. You don't try to do anything clever. You don't try to anticipate. You just say, right, we're going to penalize or reward, move things in the direction that they need to be moved. It's actually only penalties, right? If you think about this, there are no rewards. There's only penalties. The reward is not to get changed. And you can imagine other learning schemes which do involve actually making a positive increment when you get the right answer. Let's have a little demo. I can find the right page here. Yeah. So this is a little Python program that takes a set of input-output pairs. Right. So can you all read that, or is that too small? Can you read it in the back? Somebody say yes. All right. I see at least one nod. All right. So we've got, it's not very well laid out here, but here it says 0, 0 gives you 0, 0, 1 should give you 1. 1, 0 should give you 1, and 0 and 1, 1 should give you 1. All right? So that's OR. 1, 0, only 0, 0 gives you 0. And we've got two inputs with their weights and an output. And we can train using that and see what happens. And you can see what's going on. I'm going to turn my head without turning the body. Each set between dashes is one iteration, one run through all the input-output pairs, and each line says what happened, right? So the first time around, the inputs were 0. We start out with all the weights being 0, right? So the bias is 0. Both the input weights are 0. The result is we got the right answer because 0 plus 0 is 0. You know, we don't win, all right? So no error, no change. So the next time, the next line, the weights are still the same. But this time, we still predict 0 because the weights are all 0, which means that the thing is never going to fire. And that means we were wrong. We should have fired. We didn't. So we're going to increase all the weights by that were involved, right? The two weights that were involved were the bias and the second input, because you see this was the 0, 1 case. So on the third line, you see 0.1 and 0.1. I should be pointing here. Right? These two got incremented because they were the ones that were involved, and they should have gotten us over the threshold, and they didn't. So we bumped them up. But when we put in 1 and 0, we still lose in that case. So we still have an error. And so we change things yet again. We're going to increase the bias a bit more. And the one thing I realized I never told you was that the threshold that's built into this whole system and that never changes is 0.5. So we're trying to get up to 0.5 here. And at this point, when we increase these, this is still an error, so we increase everybody, We still win when the inputs are zero because we get no output, but everybody else is now good because 0.3 plus 0.2, 0.3 plus 0.2, 0.3 plus 0.2 plus 0.2, in all cases, that gets us up to 0.5, and so there's no error, and we've already won. So one set of training data was enough to learn the weights that we need for the OR function. How about AND? Oop, that took two complete iterations. Why? Because zero is almost always the right answer for AND. So it didn't get started doing any interesting learning until the fourth input, at which point it said, oh, okay, so I do need to get a positive result somehow. And it took us two rounds to get there. One increment got us 0.1 across the board. The second increment got us 0.2 across the board. Right? Why across the board? Well, because both inputs were implicated in the failure to fire, because they were both on in this case when we should have fired and didn't. So the bias and both weights got incremented. And the same thing happened at the end of the second round, which got us up to 0.2 plus 0.2 plus 0.2. Notice that 0.2 plus 0.2 is not enough. That was sort of lucky. You can see why, if the learning rate was too great, we would have overshot and started getting the wrong answer for some of the earlier cases, right? If we'd increased all the weights by too much. This happens to give us the right answer after just two iterations. Interestingly enough, nearly done here because we want to get moving. The NAND is a lot harder. It takes eight or nine iterations. And it comes up with a rather odd solution, but it's not the only solution. It's not perhaps the neatest solution. But given the particular weight, given the learning rate, it's the one that it comes up with. It basically says, gee, I'm probably going to fire, right? Because NAND is almost always true. It's true when there are no inputs true. It's true when either one of them is true. It's only false when they're both true. Right? So the bias is quite high. The way we make this work is we start with a high bias and we knock things down depending on how many inputs there are to the point where when we get both inputs on, we'll get below 0.5 and we won't fire. Right? But it did take it, wherever we are, nine, I think, iterations to get there. Fortunately, I have a threshold, I have an upper bound on the number of iterations. So when I do this, you'll see that we're never going to win. Right? It's just oscillating back and forth between two different sets of weights. Whenever it tries to make one of the halves of the XOR work, that makes the other half not work, so it goes back in the other direction. So it keeps flipping back and forth. Right? It's always going to make some kind of error. Doesn't, no matter what it does, it's going to lose. Right? And so at least this learning algorithm, as I said, this isn't a proof. It's just you can just observe that at least this training algorithm isn't capable of learning XOR, proving that no training algorithm can learn it, that in fact you can't come up with a set of weights that can do it, is, as I said, a little harder. You can extend this to more than is that the right name? Yeah. So OR is really easy. It manages to learn three input OR in just one iteration as well. I'm not going to go on with this. That's enough for today. But it is worth getting some confidence that you understand what's going on here. I'll include the Python code to do this is included in the notes. So that you can say, this program started out not knowing how to do this. And now it does know how to do it. And even though now that I understand it, it doesn't seem so clever. Nonetheless, from the outside, it is pretty clever. And indeed, it turns out that if you take off some of the restrictions that we've been operating under so far in terms of ones and zeros and start using the full range of values, perceptrons can do a very good job at binary classification tasks. That is, given a set of measurements, tell me whether the net result of this is this category or that, in or out, yes or no. Right? Given a vector of properties which are true or false or even real valued. So give me a bunch of measurements, give me the answer, do that a bunch of times, now give me some new measurements, I'll tell you what the answer is. As long as they're known, what's known as linearly separable, which surprising amounts of classification data are. That is, if you have n properties, you know, seven different measurements that you've made, and you plot the points, scatter plot the resulting points in n dimensions, if there's a plane in n minus one dimensions that will separate the two groups into the winners and the losers, the yeses and the noes, category A, category B, whatever you want to call it, if there's a boundary that's planar in one fewer dimensions, then a perceptron can learn it. And for two properties, of course, that just means that we've got a scatter plot that you can actually look at that's divisible by a straight line. So something like this, right? These are four different examples where, in fact, as the heading says there, in this case, one of the dimensions is irrelevant. You actually don't need to know the value on this dimension in order to discriminate. Likewise here. But here, the diagonal line, yeah, you do need to know both values, but these are linearly separable in two dimensions, right? With given two dimensions of input, there's a one-dimensional line that separates them. If you've got data like that, the perceptron can learn what amounts to the slope of the line, right? by coming up with the necessary weights and biases. In real life, it's worth remembering that things are rarely this neat. Here's some real data, which I should have expanded. I thought I had. You can probably just barely see enough to see. These are actually some acoustic properties of B sounds and G sounds, letter B and letter G. And what you can see is what's known as the fact that the within-group variance is often greater than the between-group variance. So the Bs and the Ds overlap, at least with respect to these two properties. They're not, in other words, linearly separable. There is no line you can draw that will divide them cleanly. So the perceptron will learn a division. Maybe it'll learn that one. But it won't be right all the time. It will just converge on the best one it can find, which may be good enough for some purposes. Things get more interesting when we add more perceptrons. Arranged in two layers, we can do N-way classification. Instead of just saying yes or no, we can say bird, fish, or fowl, right? High front vowel, high back vowel, low vowel, right? B, D, or G. Right? Pick anything like that. Arranged in two layers like this, with the connections as I've drawn them, this is what's known as fully connected feed forward. You can see why that name applies. Every input goes to every perceptron in the second layer. Perceptrons in the first layer are sort of dummies. They're just there to split the inputs up. And the connections all go in one direction. This begins to feel a little bit like some of the drawings that we saw in the very first vision lectures, right, where we were looking at actual neurons. Only the output units actually do any learning in this case, because they're the ones that have weights and a threshold. As I said, the first layer is there just to divide the inputs up. And we can train the output units independently. All we need to know is what the inputs are and whether the output is on or not in order to train it. So the same learning algorithm that we used before, the Delta rule, will do the job for this kind of two-layer network. Since each one is essentially deciding, is it me or is it something else? Right? So each one is doing a binary classification. It's me versus the rest in each case. If you think about the neural network that you worked with in the lab, the vision lab, you'll realize that if you want to tune this up a bit, you need to add inhibitory connections between the second layer, between the units on the second layer, so that only one of them can ever be really on at one time. Because the way I've just done this, there's nothing that stops us from having multiple units on at the same time. And what that means, what this means is that we can work with dirtier data, right? As long as there's a linear separation between each part of it and the rest. So the green line will do a good job of picking out, this is again a bunch of vowels in this case, against two particular acoustic properties, first and second format, I think, I've forgotten. So this guy we can do pretty well with the green line. We can say, yeah, everything sort of northwest of here is mine, and everybody else is somebody else's problem. Right? And the orange line, we can do a pretty good job on this guy, although there are a few things that we're going to get wrong, a few things that creep down from some of the higher ones, and we may miss one or two. But trying to separate out, for instance, this guy, well, we're not going to do so well at all on that. Right? As long as we've only got these two dimensions, these two properties to categorize on, trying to separate out this one from the others, we're going to get an awful lot of false positives. Right? This may not even be the best one. I just drew this by eye. For using class, for working with classifiers, by and large, the binary output isn't going to do the job for us. Instead of, in other words, computing what is called the step function, which is zero until you get over the threshold and then one, which looks sort of like that. We need, typically what's used is something called the sigmoid, a more continuous output function, right, that gives you zero for fairly low values of input, for values that are fairly far below the threshold, and close to one for things that are fairly far above the threshold, but something roughly linear in between. To say, well, you know, when you're getting close to the threshold, I'm really not sure. Maybe yes, maybe no. You know, then you can do a little better at actually dealing with noisy data by adding one form or another of mutual inhibition. We interpret the output units then by picking the most active. If you want to have an N-way classification, you've got N output units. You take the one whose value is the highest and say, that's probably it. And you have to adjust the delta rule accordingly, but that's straightforward. And the one thing you may do in order to effectively force some competition is to say that in order to get the to choose a particular output unit to actually get a result, the output has to be significantly higher than any of the others. Finally, for today, the big change comes, and this took 20 years for people to figure out, when we moved to three layers. Because then we've got a middle layer composed of what are called hidden units. And they're not input units. They're firing depends on some combination based on their input weights of different input units. And they're not output units either, right? Because they feed into different output units. And now we really can compute any logical function. There's the It's a little hard to see the weights. There are plus or minus ones. This assumes the threshold is zero, I think. I forget. Doesn't matter. You figure out what the threshold is. And we can do nonlinear classification much better. Right? But learning is a lot harder because the hidden units, we don't know what the right answer is. Right? It's not immediately obvious how to train them. We don't know whether they should be rewarded or punished. There are lots of, we're into a space of huge amounts of research and interesting alternatives. But the one that really got the whole thing off the ground, that was popularized by the people we're going to talk about next week, Rummelhardt and McClelland, is known as backpropagation, or backprop. And the core idea, the reason for the name, is something that is not too surprising, at least once somebody else has thought of it, is that you push the error back from the output units to the hidden units. You say, okay, give me a set of inputs, compute what the outputs are, match that against the desired output, that gives you an error signal for every output unit. That allows us to adjust the weights on the output unit, but it also then we can push the error back from the output units to the hidden units proportional to the weight. So if there's a very weak connection between a particular hidden unit and a particular output unit, then if that output unit is wrong, that's not really very much down to what that hidden unit did, because that hidden unit didn't really influence things very much. But if the absolute value of that connection is high, then we want to say, yeah, this hidden unit really did contribute to the mistake, either positively or negatively, depending on whether the actual value of the connection is positive or negative. So you push the errors back, sum them, the different errors coming back backwards into the hidden units, and use that as the error signal to correct the weights for the hidden units. Don't worry if you couldn't reproduce that tomorrow. You just have to get the general idea. The good news is that it works. The less good news is that it's very rare that you can look at the weights at the end of the day and look at the hidden units and say, oh yeah, the way you could in the previous slide, right? You could look at this and say, oh yeah, this is detecting the A or the A and not B case, and this is detecting the B and not A case, right? And then we can take either of those and say that's the winner, right? If either of these is, so this is an OR network working off, this hidden unit represents the A and not B case, and this hidden unit represents the B and not A case, right? It's nice and easy and straightforward to do that in that very simple network. But when you look at real networks that have been trained to do real classification tasks, you very often can't tell at all what the hidden units represent. And given that it's often the case that the best way to do this is to initialize all the weights to random weights, to random values, you'll get different results each time, even though the overall performance is the same. We'll pick it up there on Monday, I think. Tomorrow is other symbolic architectures, and I'll explain on Monday why this is called a non-symbolic architecture. Sorry, you were unsure about something I said. I'm sorry. I knew I was running out of time already.
I just wanted to say that I meant to say that if you just added another perceptron, you could get the XO with. So you just needed to add an end version of it.
But you still do. It has to be in that layered fashion.
Yeah,
well,
it didn't really bother me as a layered fashion.
Sure, go ahead.
So we have X, Y, and F. That would be, thank you.
Well, but yeah, okay, so. Indeed, but yeah. I think I'm willing to believe you, but notice that because this actually has to take input from here, it really is, we do have three layers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the equivalent. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
But you're right. This is a good answer, I think. Let me just convince myself. So if both of these are zero, no, this is no good. Right? If both of these are zero, this isn't going to fire.
Yeah, well, it's an XOR.
Oh, sorry, this I'm just thinking of NAND. Right. So if they're both zero, this guy is zero, this guy is zero, so this guy is zero, so we don't fire. Good.
Yeah.
All right? If both of these are one, this guy is one, this guy's one, this guy's one, this guy's therefore minus two, so the answer is zero, so we don't fire.
Yes.
Right? The other two cases, this guy's going to be zero, one of these will be one, as long as we do it at a greater than or equal, we're going to win. Yep. Right.
Came up with the X off.
Right, but if you...
No, it's with only X and Y input, you can't do it with one new one.
No, you really can't.
No, that much was clear. No, what I meant was, the question was whether perception can really be only one new one.
Well, no, what's interesting is if you're constrained to two inputs and an output, then you can't do it. And, but what's the other thing that's interesting?